was Louis Armstrong and Earl Hines opening up this afternoon's Fresh Air with a recording of Weatherbird. U.S. military and economic aid to El Salvador has been increasing steadily since the inauguration of Ronald Reagan. Is the junta that we're supporting in the political center, or is it representative of the right wing? Are we defending the people of El Salvador from left-wing terrorists, or are we supporting a junta responsible for the death squad murders of thousands of Salvadorans? What self-interests do we have at stake in Central America, and what action should we be willing to take to defend these interests? At 4 o'clock today, we'll debate these and other questions pertaining to U.S. involvement in El Salvador. Speaking in support of U.S. and military economic aid to the junta will be William Kintner, president of the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He has also been a military advisor, an ambassador to Thailand, and a CIA staff member. Speaking against U.S. support of the junta will be Robert Armstrong of the North American Congress on Latin America. He has also lived and worked in El Salvador. Every Tuesday on Fresh Air at 3:30, we feature Jazz Revisited, a survey of recorded jazz from 1917 to 1947. Today on a show of parallels, Hees and Schumacher compares recordings of Stardust, The Saints, and I Know That You Know. Yesterday, Department Secretary of Defense... Deputy Secretary of Defense Frank Carlucci told the Senate Armed Services Committee that the Reagan administration wants to develop military forces able to confront the Soviet Union in a long-lasting land war in Southwest Asia for use if U.S. oil supplies in the Persian Gulf are threatened. Today, Reagan's foreign policies will be analyzed by a panel of speakers as part of NPR's International Affairs magazine, Communique. In his new book, Critical Path, philosopher and inventor Buckminster Fuller addresses the problems in what he calls the greatest crisis in the history of the human race. Through tracing the origins of our social, political, and economic systems, he tries to show how we got to the precarious point that we're now in and what options we have if we're to keep the earth and life on it alive. Buckminster Fuller, who is now 85, is well known as a philosopher and architect. He has designed the Dymaction car, the geodesic dome, and the concept of spaceship Earth. He's formulated plans for floating cities, for enclosed cities, and he's organized the World Game Workshops. He's been based in Philadelphia for a number of years, since 1970, though he spends most of his time lecturing and consulting around the world. His new book, Critical Path, will be published on April 1st by St. Martin's Press. This Saturday, March 28th, I guess it's not this Saturday, he'll be at Pettingill's Bookseller, which is the bookshop at 1134 Pine Street, and he'll be there for a book signing from 1 until 4 o'clock on March 28th. Buckminster Fuller is my guest now. Welcome to Fresh Air. It's a great honor to meet you.
Delighted to be here.
At the beginning of your book, you say that for many years you hesitated to write this book. Why did you write it now, and why were you hesitating before?
Because, as happens in all of our lives, I think, we each happen by accident from time to time to be privy to some important information, only by virtue of your friend or your mother's cousin or whatever it happens to be. And you don't want to be a traitor to your trust of your friendship. As life had gone on, I went to school with the sons of very powerful financiers, and I met their fathers, and I had conversations. My days in the United States Navy, I was in really very critical trust position. For instance, I was personal aide to the admiral who was in command of the cruiser and transport force that took the million men across the ocean. I was his aide for secret information, and I was locked up in a room. I was the only one who knew where every ship we had, every one of those transports were. And the chief of naval operations had to get that information from me. I've been in many positions of really very high trust. During that operation, the transports, after the war was over, we had to prepare the steamship George Washington to carry President Wilson over to Versailles for the peace treaty after World War I. And I then was in on the developing of special telephony. We'd only had air radio telephony, very short distance from an airplane to the ship, and or from ship to ship in the Navy, when we suddenly developed transatlantic radio telephony. We talked from Brest Harbor to to Arlington for the first time in history. And I was in on, however, doing that for the State Department and for the President. I found myself in many very intimate positions. Anyway, one way or another, I'd had all these intimate experiences where I learned how and why certain things were done. I found myself, very simple things such as the fact that in the British about to lose the war, if they couldn't get the United States in time World War One, they're great. They control the world by virtue of controlling the line of supply on the three quarters of the earth, which is water. And their enemies realized that they were only protecting the surface of the sea, so the enemy went undersea in the U-boats and in the sky with airplanes. And they began to break the line of supply. The British then had the United States Navy, which was a rather poor navy, come to parity with their own navy for the first time in history. But they didn't let us elevate our guns to the same angle they elevated their own. That didn't get into the public at all. In other words, I found many such things where I saw people holding an upper hand but keeping it secret. That's all I'm trying to get at. Now, many of these things I speak about now are so ancient as to be obviously completely declassified. But there were many things to do with financial decisions that reflected our whole economy that, again, I felt were very, very intimate. I was on the staff of Fortune magazine from 1938 to 40 as the science and technology consultant, it was called, on the staff. They didn't have any editorial position like that, so they just called a consultant on the staff. I heard many of the most important sort of secrets of World War II was about to come on. I was doing a story, say, of the Sperry Gyroscope Company that had very secret devices like particularly the things you could do with the gyroscope. At any rate, they had the bomb sight control and things like that. So, I mean, there's many positions like that. But I didn't want to be called a class traitor in putting these many things together. But in order to really do a competent and really worthwhile review of what I knew about history, I had really to include all these things that I knew about. And many of them really tremendously secret. And so, how can I write such a book? Not be called class traitor. I finally got to the point where I realized that humanity really is in such a crisis that I'd be a traitor to humanity, not to try to put the story together. And I'd go out of my way to make sure that people don't think of good and bad people, that history, evolution has to have its checks and balances. So there has to be in Mr. X doing function X in relation to Mr. Y. And so the many of the people doing function X, I wouldn't like to have to be in their position.
I know that you think we're at a very critical time in the history of the planet now. What do you think are the factors that make this time as critical and as dangerous as it is?
Well, it was clear to me in committing myself at age of 32, which is 53 years ago, to an experiment to see what a little individual, unknown, penniless, might be able to do effectively on behalf of all humanity that great nations and great corporations were inherently incapable of doing. And in the first place, only human beings can think. A corporation is a legal entity, it can't think as a legal entity. So I then found that all the great nations were preoccupied naturally with their own nation, which are on the dry land. The average of the 150 nations on our planet right now, they only are concerned with 1/12 of 1% of the surface of the Earth. Get an idea how really small they are. And I found the great corporations were out enormous gamble, and a ship had to come in within a reasonable amount of time or they went bust. So they were inherently short-sighted. Having been a regular United States naval officer, which was very lucky, I tended to think about the total water world, which is 3/4 of the Earth, rather than the landed side, and having actually, as I've been commanding officer on several ships, I saw nothing to stop me of looking at our total planet Earth as a spaceship, which it really is, and as a passenger ship with all these human beings on board. I said, can I not take the total know-how thus far accumulated and all the known physical resources, all their special capabilities, and employ them integratively for all humanity, and in such a manner as to take care of all humanity. Whereas everybody's operating on our planet politically on a basis there's nowhere nearly enough to go around, going back to the beginning of the British Empire's great rule of the world in with Trafalgar in 1805, when Thomas Malthus was the professor of political economics of the East India Company College, where all the data of 200 years of exploration of the British Empire had been filed, all the data they had about a spherical Earth. After this time, all the great the great empires had all been flat empires, whether it's Genghis Khan or Roman Empire. They'd all occurred before you knew we were on the sphere. And so suddenly the British Empire is the first time after Magellan when you know you're on a sphere. So we have Thomas Malthus with the total data from a closed system sphere saying this is very different from an open system going to infinity. And he found, as he said in his first book, that quite clearly humanity was reproducing itself at a geometrical rate and producing life support only at an arithmetical rate, and therefore majority of humanity had to live out the years in great want and pain. And he said, pray all you want, won't do any good, that's all there is. Then we had a few, 60 years later, Malthus, we have Darwin, survival only the fittest. We have Karl Marx, contemporary of of Darwin, saying, nowhere near enough. I accept Malthus as pure science, I accept Darwin as pure science. And to me then, the worker is the fittest to survive because he knows how to handle tools and cultivate the seed. And these other people are parasites. And other people said, according to Darwin, survival of the fittest, we're on top of the heaps, therefore, quite clearly, we're here because we should be. And because the workers are dull and unenterprising, and we are exactly what's necessary. So it's brought about the two great political camps of humanity of the present time, where for the last 30 years, Russia and the United States buying over $200 billion a year to see which one is fittest to survive as a political system. Each one saying, you may not personally like our system, but we're convinced we have the most logical and ingenious way of coping with lethal inadequacy of life support on our planet. And because there are those who disagree diametrically on how to cope, it has to be resolved by trial of arms, which system is fittest to survive. We have to realize that's what's going on. And this enormous appropriation going on right now this year, whereas it used to be $200 billion between the two, last year between the two it was $400 billion, or approximately $200 billion each. This year, Reagan's working up to $368 billion by two years from now. And all taking the highest capability of humanity and concentrating on how to kill more and more people at greater and greater distance in a shorter and shorter time, instead of how to make the world work. Now, this is where back 53 years ago I saw that there was an invisible revolution going on that society didn't pay any attention to because you couldn't see it. That was the increase of alloy strength, where we find then, for instance, I'll just give you the mild steel of 1851 ran our first steel manufacturing, 50,000 pounds square inch tensile strength. Brooklyn Bridge came in at 70,000. World War I, we had chrome molybdenum steel for aircraft, 110,000. World War II, chrome nickel steel got up to 350,000 tensile strength. The Gossamer Albatross that flew across the Atlantic and the sails of the America's Cup Defenders were what you call carbon fiber, got up to 600,000 pounds tensile strength for the same weight. That is where same weight of material is giving you exactly 10 times the performance. Now, this is invisible, and all the electronics are invisible, all the computers are invisible, and society is all specialized, so they can't see and understand the invisibility in somebody else's department. And I saw then, because we were doing more with less, and been doing all these things long that Malthus never anticipated, the invisible revolution. I saw back in 1917 in the Navy that it could be possible someday we might be able to do so much with so little, we might be able to take care of everybody, and that whereas the social sciences, and particularly economics, which counsels all of politics, hoped they had found a generalized principle like Newton's gravitational law, when the great model in all economics is fundamental scarcity. And I saw that this might not be an absolute law, and I pursued it through my years, and I bring it particularly to apply to what I call livingry or the home, rather than the weaponry or how to kill. And I found that our building industry comes out of yesterday's castles and fortresses, and the bigger and heavier and higher the walls, the more secure people felt. But when we get an environment control for the sky, like the 747, and where you're flying at actually 10 times the speed of a hurricane, and the resistance in the air increases the second power of the speed, so that the actual ferocity of interaction of Boeing 747 in the atmosphere is 100 times the ferocity of a hurricane. You see what I'm saying? And you do that little delicate wall. So if I could take that kind of technology and apply it to the home front, we might get somewhere. And that's exactly what I found we can do.
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying that the real global problem isn't scarcity, isn't lack of resources, but what, selfishness, self-interest? People defending their own territory and wanting to get more and more for themselves, whether that's more energy for themselves or more profits, is that it?
I'm saying down that with a fundamental assumption that there's not enough to go around, we rationalize selfishness and we say, why am I warranted in looking out for my life? Why does God like my family a little better, therefore I can warrant in depriving this other family of their living? It's been a very sad kind of thing. And I felt that if we could overcome that, we'd have a very, very different kind of a relationship to the universe. Now, I would like you have some very good questions, but I'd like to bring in to understand at all about humans in the universe, which became my concern back 53 years ago. I said, what's different about humans than any other living organism? I found that many creatures had brains. Almost all creatures other than humans have some special built-in equipment that gives them special advantage in a special environment. But we apparently were designed for sort of a total challenge of all environments, and we were given the brains that are always dealing in coordinating the information in our senses, the smellings, the touching, the hearing, always special case. But human minds have a capability from time to time to discover relationships existing between special cases and not manifest by examination of a single case by itself, special case. For instance, we have this extraordinary business when Kepler was able then to discover that whereas we had the planets going around the sun, and that they were all different sizes, all different distance from the sun, all going around the sun at different rates. He said, we at least know one thing going around the sun. If I can give them something else in common as a mathematician. I give them all exactly the same amount of time. I'd like to see what each one does in the same amount of time. He had the distance each one was from the sun to start off with. He made a diagram of that distance. Then he made a diagram of the arc to the end of his given time. They made long, thin triangular patterns, sort of like pieces of pie. And he had the data, so he said, I might as well calculate these areas. And he calculated the areas of these long, thin triangular pies, and he found the areas were not similar. They were exactly the same area. He said, they're obviously coordinating. If they were touching each other like gears, I can understand how they could coordinate, but they are millions of miles apart. How do you coordinate at millions of miles apart? There's nothing that human eye can see. There's nothing that the brain could deal with, which you could only do if you could see it. So here's human mind discovering this extraordinary relationship. And out of this came eventually Galileo's work and then Newton's ability to write the formula that the interattractiveness of celestial bodies was varying inversely as the second power of the arithmetical distances intervening. So we have human mind suddenly demonstrating a capability to find laws of the universe, because these great generalized laws to be accepted by science must have no exceptions. And if there's no exception, it means it's inherently eternal. So we have humanity's mind dealing with eternal and the brain dealing with the temporal, the things that begin and end. Brains ask for a beginning and ending of universe, but mind deals with that eternal. Now, the fact that humans, then have been able to discover a number of these generalized principles, demonstrating that these principles themselves are really the very essence of the design of the universe, that humans have been admitted to some of the designing of the universe itself, knowledge of it, means we must be here for some very important reason, yet we're all, we can observe, born naked, helpless, no experience, absolute ignorant, as deliberate design. The same universe that could design our optical system and our brains also had us deliberately born naked and hungry and thirsty and forced us to learn only by trial and experiment, trial and error. And so we've had to make an enormous number of mistakes, and I don't, as at present times, you and I sit here talking and you ask me about the President of the United States and this and that. I know we have to learn by experience and by error, so that some very large errors being made that were perfectly valid actions of yesterday, which no longer work. When I was born, humanity was completely deployed, remote from one another. The remotest from one another, using the fastest known vehicle, took 6 months to reach each other. I was born before the 8 years before the Wright brothers flew. I was 7 years of age when the first automobile came into Boston, Massachusetts. I was born in a completely different era when humanity was very remotely deployed. As I came into Harvard University 2 years before the retiring president of Harvard, President Eliot, and his wife and granddaughter and a young Harvard graduate made the first trip around the world where you buy your ticket on the railroad train and ship. Wonderfully, nobody knew whether you could do that, so the newspapers followed them around the world. Today, to go around the world, I'm one of 10 million that have been around the world. I've been around the world 47 times as part of my work. So that I find humanity is now was deliberately remote, and now we're being integrated. And so I see these big things are going on, and we had to learn words first so we could tell each other about what you could eat. We had to be able to intercommunicate our experiences. Then we got to learn how to write the words so that the dead could write to the living about their experiences. People who had lived far away could send you their experiences. So we've been gradually integrating information. And in my life, we've gone from 95% illiterate humanity to 60% literate, twice many people, but 60% literate. We're at a point where if you were illiterate yesterday, you had to have leaders. You had to have the political leaders. Suddenly, if you're all getting majority literate and everybody's in on the information, we need a completely different way of making decisions and carrying on. We may be really qualifying for world democracy for the first time in history.
Well, as you say, you've seen all these inventions happen in America. You were born before there were cars and before the Wright brothers flew. You've also seen many presidents come and go, many governments in different parts of the world be built and then collapse and get rebuilt again. Do you follow politics closely now? Is it important to you to observe what leaders in different parts of the world are doing? Or are you thinking in lines very outside of the day-to-day political happenings going on around us?
I keep track of everything I can. I'm deliberately a comprehensivist. But some things I see are fading out in their value to humanity. I see humanity still assuming political solutions are essential. And I committed myself to solving problems by using this invisible revolution of doing more with the same or more with less. So I've been at that for 53 years, and finally my geodesic domes are all around the world. They're over, getting pretty close to 300,000 of them now. They are ringing the north between ourselves and Russia. They are over the South Pole. They're everywhere, very remote places. But anyway, I've learned enough about logistics and the doing more with less revolution, so that 10 years ago, keeping score of all these things year by year, I now, as of 10 years ago, I found we'd gotten to a point where the first time in history could be engineeringly demonstrated with a design revolution. We could melt up all the metals now going into the weaponry and using them properly for what I call a living room. Within 10-year design revolution, we could have all humanity living at a higher standard living than anybody that's ever known, and do so on a sustaining basis while phasing out all further use of fossil fuels and atomic energy. Now, you might say, after you make such a public announcement, I course was checked up by a great many competent people, and they found possibly over 1,000 people have checked me in very carefully and found I'm actually correct. But there are 4 billion human beings on our planet. But the point was, I was a scorekeeper. I didn't bring this about. It was a consequence of all humanity's activity. But by far, most is its report. It was a consequence of the invisible revolution. And because it's invisible, people can't see it. They don't realize that when you combine the Gossamer albatross, where you do so much with so little, you could peg yourself by air across the British Channel, and combine that with a satellite, communication satellite that came in 15 years ago, where three quarters of a ton satellite outperformed over 700,000 tons of transoceanic cable. And so I found society was not adding this up to all the different ones, but I did so. Now, the point is that I now learn that we can solve our problems by a proper environment that's so informing that we can have a humanity that is well-informed, making decisions in a very different kind of a way.
My guest is R. Buckminster Fuller, if you're just tuning in. Now, you and I know a lot of our listeners have read your books and know something of your philosophy and your theories for making the resources of the world available to the people who need them. And now you're talking about political self-interest and how that's working against the use of philosophies like yours. What kind of ways exist, do you think, to use philosophies like yours so that resources can be used and spread out evenly around the world instead of self-interest controlling what gets done with the resources that exist? In other words, I guess I'm asking you, how seriously have political leaders taken you, or people who own the corporations that control that market a lot of the inventions that are made?
Many of the great corporate heads know me and know me well. I don't think many of the politicians, for instance, I wouldn't be surprised if Reagan never heard of me, and really, in all earnestness. And what I do observe is evolution is doing some tremendously important things. Number one, every child born successively is born in the presence of less misinformation. I want you to realize, when I was young, for my first 8 years, which are very impressionistic, I've been told by all the grown-ups, it's inherently impossible for a man to fly. They said, Wireless, how crazy can you get? When I was 12, we have the first SOS. So I want you to realize what the children, I had an enormous amount to unlearn. The kids not having to unlearn like that. And each child born successfully, being born in the presence of a great deal more reliable information. So I find there's a very enormous evolution there. I was asked by a Los Angeles newspaper man if I would be willing to have an interaction with some very young people. He wanted to see how they did get on with me, and he heard me talk about young people. So he chose a boy 12 and another boy 11 and a little girl 10. And he gave them a number of my books, and to his surprise, they were able to read them. And they then wrote questions. 3 months later, he had them prepare questions. Then they met with me on a Sunday, and they asked me a series of questions. The questions could not have been written better by the president of Harvard University, as far as that goes. And I answered them. It took half a day to do that. When the questioning was over, I asked the older boy what his fun was. He said he was learning to be a magician. I asked the 11-year-old boy, and he said, I'm interested in electronics. I asked the 10-year-old girl, and she said, I'm a comprehensivist like you. I'm interested in everything. And the difference was, she's 10. The boys were born before man got to the moon, and she was born after. And I find nature made an enormous cutoff here, because historically, getting to the moon was the impossible, the absolute nonsense, if you want to say, lunatic, if you touch the moon. She's born where humanity did an enormous investment, and all the young world knew about all the things that had to be done to get man over the moon and back safely. I'm getting 4 or 5 letters a year from kids who are born after the moon saying, humanity can do anything it needs to do, why don't we make this world work? So you tell me, I want you to understand, I see evolution very powerful at work herself, trying to make humanity a success. and taking care of all the misconditioned reflexes of yesterday of people like myself who are not used to dealing in the invisible world. So I find that younger world very much accrediting. There are many other investigators of this subject, and there's a magazine called New Age, or it's one of those new specials. Anyway, they have me talking with some very young children, very much the same kind of things I just told you about, and they found that the young people say that I talk their language. It's interesting because I've tried to get rid of the words in my language that don't have meaning. I'm not allowed to use the words up and down because there's no up and down in the universe. And these kids have found that's correct. So they say I'm talking their language. Isn't that interesting? When I'm only talking really my own, sort of house clean language.
No, I understand what you're saying about the trip to the moon having changed the way we think. But although we've sent people to the moon, and although all these wonderful technical feats have been accomplished, one still has a lot of problems getting from one part of Philadelphia to the other, and, you know, finding a good means of birth control. And, I mean, just all these really day-to-day things don't exist. And in a lot of countries, people are working with very, very primitive farming tools, and in very primitive and poor conditions. Even in America, a lot of people are living in great poverty. So this incredible disparity exists all the time between what we're capable of and what you're really living with. I never traveled to the moon. I saw it on TV, but I was never there. So I feel that a lot of us experience this great confusion between the possible
the point
and
was not
the real.
You're traveling to the moon with the ability to do the what had been considered impossible if you really make up your mind, but you have this enormous capital investment. So would humanity then make the capital investment to exercise the option to make it that I've discovered we have the option to make now? I think it's absolutely touch and go whether we will learn to do so. And nothing's going to happen exactly overnight. Nature doesn't have any instant babies. They're always gestation periods, and the most important things take the longest. So I assumed at least a 50-year period back in 1927 before my kind of artifact revolution might begin to have some effectiveness. I did start off with, for instance, you got to be able to see your planet right, so I did get out a new mathematical method of projection, the surface of the Earth, so you can see the whole surface of the Earth as one world island, one world ocean without any visible distortion. So you were, and then I could put the 100 dots on there, each representing 1% of humanity, where they actually exist. You begin to see some of the motions of humanity, where 9% are still in the water in the Philippines and Japan, and coming up in the land from being naked, et cetera, et cetera.
One of the big crises that we face today is the energy crisis. We seem to be running out of finite resources and don't have a very safe, reliable alternative. Nuclear power has proven to be a pretty dangerous alternative to finite resources. Do you think that there is an energy problem, and do you see ways around it? Because also it seems that some of the international battles that may be on the verge of being fought also might be about who controls the energy resources that exist. So what are some of the alternatives you see out of the energy problems that we have, both in terms
there,
of
there
who
is
controls
actually,
it
there
and
is,
how much
there's
there is
no energy problem whatsoever. It's only a problem of ignorance, number one, and the lack of capability to get the information to the people, because the media is unfortunately very much controlled by the large money. And the largest money we have in the world is oil money. And the oil money then acquired the control of the atomic energy plants and assumes if oil's all through, that's the way they're going to make their enormous income. So that you can't break through that barrier. The fact is, this is an absolutely hard fact, and I have a book, and you can get it from Doubleday, called Energy, Earth, and Everyone, written by Medard Gable. He was the head of my World Game group, in which you can find out that today that the total energy being employed by humanity on our planet amounts to only 1/6 millionth of 1% of our daily energy income on this planet. 1/6 millionth of 1%, all the energy we're using. And we find big power structure and big government, the government needs lots of money and get it by taxes. Doesn't see any way of putting meters between people and the universe, where we could really get these energies directly. So that nothing is being done seriously. Going way back to, let's say, World War II, one of the grand strategies against Hitler was to cut off his petroleum, and the Allies succeeded. Immediately, the German scientists were put to work on the problem, and they were able to develop enough alcohol just from the trees, because they had then very well scientific reforestation. From the trees, they were able to produce enough alcohol to produce all their high-octane airplane gas, their synthetic rubber programs, everything. Germany was not licked on energy, though they had all petroleum cut off, went over to alcohol. I was head mechanical engineer in the Board of Economic Warfare and on the committee, Inter-Allied Committee of Alternate Materials. I handed the Bureau of Standards three automobile engines, a Chevrolet, a Ford, and a Plymouth. We ran them on the dynamometer blocks there for 2 years on alcohol, and they ran better than they do on gasoline. I can't get any newspaper to publish this. I just want to say, the crisis is one of fear. People who have jobs, they feel, I better not put that in my column or whatever it is, and so forth.
So you think that the energy crisis doesn't really exist?
Absolutely. No such thing.
And so what do you think are the barriers then?
The universe is nothing but energy. Every star is an atomic energy plant. We now know of 100 billion stars in our galaxy. We know 2 billion galaxies with that many stars each. Everyone is an atomic energy plant. But in order to have human beings in an environment where, being 60% water, we won't boil or freeze, where our very delicate tissue can actually, we only planet we know where we have those conditions in our biosphere. And nature then, in order to have us in the universe with this important mind, and having capability to access some of the great design problems, had us here for a very important function. If we could go from all the way from being naked and ignorant to finally discovering our mind is everything, and our muscle is nothing. And we're at that sort of critical threshold now where we've had enormous resources which by trial and error to learn that our mind is everything and our muscle is nothing. And at the present time, muscle and cunning are still in control of human affairs and fear and ignorance. So where this, can we cross that threshold where our individual minds, your mind, what you were able to do on your radio as you talk to people, as you exhibit integrity with your mind and really have the courage to talk about what needs to be talked about, all those things are the tests we're going through as to whether we can really graduate to where human mind of all the individuals really amount to something. And we're making decisions with our mind and not in terms of who has the greatest firepower and the greatest bomb reserve and so forth. Now, I want you to, if you can, to feel that threshold moment, and which is, to me, absolutely touch and go whether we make it. These are the kind of things I have in my book, Critical Path. Critical Path is everything I know about this situation, everything I know about history, everything I know about the power structure games that have been played, and I don't have good and bad people in it, but just really trying to understand what it is all about.
You say you don't like to use the word good and bad, but as you said before, you know, we come into the world unclothed, and we come into the world with a lot of conflicting needs and emotions. And although we all have the potential to do wonderful things, we also have the potential to be very selfish. Do you think that there is much of a potential for a world system like the one you think we'd need in order to reverse a lot of the problems that we're involved with?
You have some very lovely hair, and you don't even know why you have hair. You didn't design your eyes, you didn't design any of you. We didn't design the 92 chemical elements, we didn't design 2 billion galaxies. We don't have design about anything, we didn't design gravity, we don't know why things hold together. But I do know that every human being, when in good health, are giving off 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, that it's so balanced, it's so delicately balanced, and that we are in this biosphere, and that we do have minds, and we quite clearly are here for local universe information gathering and local universe problem solving, to really do with our minds, if we can really graduate to where the individual has courage to go along with his own mind, not be worried about the the fact that we came out of a long pattern of trial and error, we've had to make some enormous errors in order to see what to really to do. So the things we can talk about today, which I wouldn't call good or bad, are at least something very clear. They're in deep, great acceleration, enormous amount going on in my generation, your generation, compared to what any generation before us. So just in these next 4 years, if we still stay here, we're going to go through such transition that history hasn't had any precedent for it whatsoever.
What do you think of our country's president?
Yeah.
What do you think of President Reagan? What do you think of him? Because I know that you are following politics.
I look on him as he's an actor, and he was picked as an actor, and he's by virtue of power structure. To get in a president, you need some well over $50 million. To get to be a senator, you need at least $5 million. To get to be a representative, you need over $1 million. And as the whole young world then figures, if you have all that money is involved, obviously it's corrupt. So I don't think President Reagan has the slightest idea what's going on. I think he was very clearly picked by a very incredibly powerful structure. As Critical Path makes clear, all the really great wealth of America and the kudos of the American people has been taken, stolen from America and been taken to out of America, as we might call the Fortune 500, and their legal departments, everything, say what you have to do. And I see people you might think of as very powerful people, they can't make any decisions. The lawyers tell them what to do. And Reagan is very much of a puppet. And I feel very sorry for him. I'm glad that he feels as happy as he seems to feel. And I hope he's able to stay that way, because I don't think he has much to do with what goes on. And I think he's going to be find himself. I would not like to be the last president of the United States. And nature is now about to eliminate the 150 nations. We have only one ship and we have 150 admirals. It was all very well to have a separate nation when we were really inherently divided physically. But today we're all being integrated. And we're going to have to, we have 150 blood clots. Our minds are no longer in the hills. We're closing up the great anaconda and so forth. Well, I don't need it anymore, because 70% of all of the copper comes out of the yesterday scrap. And so the scrap circulation gets really blocked by the separate nations, where their financial interests are challenged, and they really try to corrupt the laws. And so we have many blood clots. All that has to go. So Reagan is the president of the most difficult of all the sovereign nations to have to go. The dictator can make a deal with another dictator without referring the people whatsoever. Or a dictatorial party like the Communist Party can make a deal with another dictator. But we have a quasi-democracy, and the first thing the president swears as he takes his oath of office is to protect the sovereignty of his country. And if he would ever talk about de-sovereignizing, you'd be immediately impeached. So I see Reagan's in a very tough kind of position where we're phasing out individual nations and going to have to all... So he's in a very tough position, dear, and that's why I say I feel he's a little pathos there.
Buckminster Fuller is my guest, if you're just joining us. You've referred a few times to an organizing principle. Like you said, you know, we have hair and we have eyes, and we don't know how they were created or why or what function they serve, but we've got them. Do you consider yourself to be a religious man, or is it a different organizing principle that you refer to?
Well, 53 years ago, when I made up my mind to make myself this experiment, see what the little individual could do, I saw that I'd get nowhere trying to talk to 3 billion people. I only had 10 years to go, theoretically, in life expectancy insurance law. So I said, I can be effective in making artifacts, but I'm going to need a lot of money to produce the prototypes and to test and be sure they really work. Otherwise, I'm going to need tools, machinery, people, and I don't have anybody who thinks I'm making any sense. And I'm launching on a 50-year program, not to try to make any money. It was going to need a lot of money. I said, I'll have to assume. I'm going to make my study of what I think, trying to find out from all the experience we have so far, how and why humans are here in the universe. And I decided we are here then as a function that we would graduate to when we finally learned to dare to go along with our mind, that we were up to now doing things inadvertently, that we were designed as you design all of ecology, where you don't tell the bumblebee, I want you to go out and cross-pollinize. We say the honey, go after honey. And inadvertently, the bee bumbles off the pollen off and keeps the cross-fertilization going. So I saw humanity was doing the same bumblebeeing and inadvertently developing the right technology. I said, if I were to then commit myself instead of having to have the technology forced upon us by our assumption of war that it has to be you or me and only funding it for that, if I make my working assumption that I'm going to work on how to make humanity physical success through the more with less, if I'm doing what evolution wants done, then I might finally get on without any financial support by anybody, that I will get what I need when I need it. Just exactly as hydrogen atom doesn't have to earn a living before behaving like a hydrogen atom. In fact, I found human beings, we seem to be the only ones playing this strange game of having to earn a living before it makes sense. And so I said, I'm going to have to make, this is really the great experiment. Can I trust the intellectual integrity of the universe itself, that it is wise to have human beings here as local problem solvers and so forth, and I commit myself to making them physically successful so they can attend to that and not to the nonsense of earning a living. If I'm doing what's wanted, I find myself getting on, so somebody must find out whether that's correct. So I, for 53 years now, my average expenditures annually runs today over $250,000. People in my office, you go over and talk to these wonderful people, they used to be scared to death because there are $250,000 of bills are coming in all the time. You don't know where they're coming from because I don't have any agents or anybody to promote. I don't allow any promotion. I said, nature has her own gestation rate, so I mustn't tamper with this thing at all. I must really commit myself completely to just working on those artifacts. And so I find just as I need something, but only at the absolute last minute does it come. And it always comes in a completely surprising way, absolute real way, of course, because it's real. And if it doesn't come, then it's because I'm steering the wrong course. I must give up what I was trying to do here. And so it's the only way I've learned. But at any rate, I've gotten on for this 53 years, really absolute pure miracle, well over $10 million that I have been able to invest in prototypes and so forth, all through having a faith, absolute faith, a commitment, 100% faith. You don't go on an experiment unless you do, that there is an intellectual integrity governing this universe. And our commitment, you can call it God, or whatever name we call it, it's always inadequate to something that's incredible. It's a really great design and intellectual integrity of the universe. And I'm 100% committed.
An intellectual integrity, I take that to mean that you don't follow a specific religion, that you believe in some kind of a force that you don't fully comprehend, but that exists, but that you're not following any religious rituals or ways of observing that force or communicating directly with it outside of your intellectual pursuits.
I define the word believe as accepting explanations of physical phenomena without any experimental evidence. I don't believe anything at all. That's when my grandmother told me, darling, you must believe because you know how much I love you and I think this is correct, so you believe it. And I don't have any of that. I must have all experimental evidence. But what I am impressed with these beautiful, extraordinary scientific laws we have found to be operative, and that they're only expressible mathematically, and mathematics is purely intellectual. So there's quite clearly an intellectual a priori of these eternal laws which are operative. And so I said, I'm overwhelmed with the evidence of a greater intellect operating a priori, a great designing capability to that of humans. I'm overwhelmed by the design of a human being.
We're close to being out of time, but I know that you've designed so many things and you've designed so many ideas as well. Which are the ones that at this point in time you consider to be the most useful and the most important?
I'm dealing then with the universe. I can't say that any one of the 92 chemical elements is more important than the other. I can't say that any of the laws are more important than the other. So it's the interaction. That's what we mean by the word synergy. The behavior of whole systems unpredicted by the behavior of any of the parts considered separately. So I don't have favorites of anything. I'm only interested really in the totality.
Okay. Buckminster Fuller, I want to thank you so very much for talking to us this afternoon. It's really been exciting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Buckminster Fuller, and he has a new book that's going to be published at the end of the month. And this book is called Critical Path, and it has in it a lot of the ideas that he's been discussing this afternoon, and it's published by the St. Martin's Press. And if you'd like to meet him, he will be at a book signing on March 28th. At Pettingill's bookseller at 1134 Pine Street, and he'll be there between 1 and 4 o'clock. And I ought to mention that Buckminster Fuller's book, Critical Path, was written with Kiyoshi Kurumiya, who also participated in this book. And Buckminster Fuller has been based in Philadelphia for 11 years, but as you probably know, he spends most of his time traveling around the world, lecturing and consulting and doing projects in cities around the world. Thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to speak with us.
I thank you for being so intelligent, pleasing, and lock it in.
Thank you. It's 6 minutes to 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY FM in Philadelphia. We heard Gary Burton and Chick Corea playing a duet on a piece written by Steve Swallow called Radio. It's a minute to three, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY FM in Philadelphia. Well, Buckminster Fuller just shared with us some very exciting ways of looking at world politics. We're going to be spending a good deal of this afternoon looking at some other points of view on American involvement in world politics. In an hour on Fresh Air, we're going to have a debate on what the U.S. policy should be in El Salvador. And with me will be William Kintner, who's the president of the Foreign Policy Research Institute, which is based in Philadelphia. His area of specialization is defense and national security policy, American foreign policy, and Soviet strategy in Asia. He's also a former ambassador to Thailand, and he thinks that the United States is right in sending economic and military support to the junta in El Salvador. Also with me at 4 o'clock will be Robert Armstrong, who is against the current U.S. military involvement in Salvador. He's a staff member of a group called NACLA, and that's an acronym for the North American Congress on Latin America. This is a research institute that was founded in 1966. He's worked and lived in El Salvador. He co-founded the Minimum Housing and Development Foundation there, and he's a member of the coordinating committee of the Committee in Solidarity with the Salvadorian People. So this discussion will be beginning at 4 o'clock this afternoon on Fresh Air. Well, how are politicians and political watchers evaluating the policies of our new president as they're being formed and articulated? That's the subject of this week's edition of Communique, NPR's international affairs magazine. And we're about to hear a panel discussion in which four people will be appraising President Reagan's foreign policy.
From National Public Radio, this is Communique, the weekly report on world affairs. Our host for this week's edition is Morton Kondracki, executive editor of the New Republic magazine.
On the evening of February 24th, Communique joined forces with the Foreign Policy Institute of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies here in Washington for the first of several planned forums to examine the foreign policy issues and challenges facing the Reagan administration. The audience was invited from Capitol Hill, the State Department, the news media, and graduate students at Hopkins. Our panel of four distinguished experts represented a range of viewpoint and ideology. Republican Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana, Democratic Congressman Les Aspin of Wisconsin, former Assistant Secretary of State Richard Holbrooke, and former arms control negotiator Paul Nitze. We asked each of them to briefly outline the most significant problems they see at present and in the near future, a time period we referred to as just over the horizon. Following their comments, the audience was invited to question the panel. We've edited the session down to half an hour for our radio audience. We'll begin with Paul Nitze, currently chairman of the Committee on the Present Danger, a conservative policy group based in Washington. He formerly served as Secretary of the Navy, Deputy Secretary of Defense, and on the negotiating team for the first SALT Treaty.
My view is that the Soviet Union propaganda and psychological warfare techniques have been really very successful over a number of years. And they've been successful by virtue of the constant repetition of the themes that they've hammered on. And in also because of the fact that they take measures to see to it that there are very few alternatives left to those on whom they're bringing pressure. Now, in that context, I mean, if these are the facts which the Reagan administration has to face, I think they've got a very difficult road to hoe, and particularly one in which they have to deal with the psychological, political warfare aspects of the situation with great skill and wisdom. Now, whether they're really in good shape to do that or not, whether they'll learn how to do that well, that is one of the things I think one has to see. Thank you.
Our second speaker is Richard Holbrooke, who served in the Carter administration as Assistant Secretary for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, where he was involved in developing policy on improved relations with China, responsible for handling the continuing crises in Southeast Asian trouble spots such as Cambodia. He joined the Foreign Service in 1962, having graduated from Brown and Princeton, and served in Vietnam on the White House staff and at the Paris peace talks. Mr. Holbrooke.
Thank you, Mort. The central point of the administration's policy is self-evident, the reaffirmation of American power and our willingness to use it to defend our national interests throughout the world. Now, to a certain extent, this is an attempt, I think, to over-dramatize the perceived weakness in the last 4 years. I obviously do not feel that the inherited policy was as weak as it has been portrayed. But I do want to stress that I personally, and I hope almost everyone, would share the view that this reaffirmation of American power in defense of our national interests is, in a philosophical and theoretical sense, an essential part of an American foreign policy. Going along with that will be an increasing emphasis, clearly, on U.S.-Soviet relations in a bipolar context. It's become increasingly apparent in the last week with the emphasis on El Salvador and the new attitude towards the relationship between U.S.-Soviet policy and the Mideast settlement that the new administration will see more issues in bipolar terms than any administration in a long time. But I do think that while reacting to Soviet power is an essential part of foreign policy, it should not be the sole factor in discussing foreign policy issues. And if perhaps in the past it was unduly minimized, I hope that there will not be a reaction and it will be overemphasized.
Thank you, Dick. Our next speaker is Senator Richard Lugar, the senior senator from Indiana. He was a businessman in Indianapolis and became mayor of that city in 1968. In 1976, he ran for and was elected to the Senate, where he now serves on the Foreign Relations Committee, the Intelligence Committee, Agriculture, Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs. Senator Lugar holds the distinction of being one of the first members of the Senate to be targeted for defeat by the liberal version of NCPAC. And although that may sound ominous, the committee has also confessed that they're probably likely to lose the race and that Senator Lugar will be back next time. Congratulations on that, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much, Warren. I appreciate the generosity of your introduction and prediction. Now, as we look over the horizon, it seems to me that one is struck by the fact that most other countries of the world have much the same sort of problem. In other words, this is a time in which, in many ways, people might be returning to national strategies, to geopolitical thinking, less to a worldwide ideological struggle, a very pragmatic problem of how are we going to make it? Literally, how will the bills be paid? It is one thing for nations to have aspirations and another to be able to afford those policies. And it seems to me that coincident with this view of nationalism and the pragmatic thinking of how